Four rungs on Jacob's ladder.
Well, as Michael said, we're going to introduce our lesson today with two questions. The hymn that we just sung was once sung at a very notable historic occasion. Do any of you recall that great event in history when these words were sung? George? Sinking of the Titanic. As the Titanic went under, and all around the Titanic were the women and children in lifeboats. The men gathered, the band played, and they sang, "Nearer, My God, to Thee," as it went below the waters. And that should be a reminder to us of the need we have to enter into the sorrows of the world around us, to realize that there are many Titanics. There are many things that bring men to a sudden termination of their lives. We know not when our termination will be. Each day brings us nearer our God to Thee, and someday it will be that final crossing of the bridge. The second question, this hymn, when the author penned the words, had a Bible story in mind. What Bible story is the basis for this hymn? Bob?
Jacob.
Jacob's ladder. That's the correct answer to that. And that is our subject today. Our title is Four Rungs on Jacob's Ladder. In the hymn, I like the analogy, or two analogies, that the poet makes to Jacob's ladder. In the first verse, the ladder is likened to a cross. Even though it be a cross that raiseth me. That really is the ladder for each of us. It's the realization of the access we have to God through the cross of Christ. But in addition to that access, in the third verse, the ladder is likened to the light of truth. Bright doth thy truth appear, shining from heaven. This light thou sendest me in mercy given. Lord, I would scale this height, nearer to be. My soul was wing its flight quickly to Thee. Merely having the fact that Christ died does not give us access. We need to have the truth of that embedded into us so that we have the faith of Christ to motivate us to act upon that if we are going to have this ladder extending between us and the heavenlies. It's the second verse that is particularly related to the story we're going to talk about. Though like a wanderer, daylight all gone. That was Jacob's experience that day. He had come to the end of the day. Darkness comes over him. My rest, the stone. He had chosen a pillow, stone for his pillow. Yet even here I be, nearer my God to thee. The story of Jacob's ladder is found in Genesis chapter 28. And it's a rather long story, but I'm going to read the entire story. Because there are lessons in this that I picked up in the New Testament and that have an effect for us and a larger effect for the whole human race. Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran and delighted upon a certain place and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And he took of the stones of that place and put them for his pillows and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up upon the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it, and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, thy father, and the God of Isaac. The land wherein thou liest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth. And thou shalt spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in thee and thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again to this land. For I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. And Jacob awakened out of his sleep, and he said, Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. And he was afraid, and said, How dreadful is this place! This is none other but the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. And Jacob rose up early in the morning, and took the stone that he had put for his pillows, and set it up for a pillar, and poured oil upon the top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel. but the name of that city was called Luz at the first. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, If God will be with me, and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat, and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. And this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house, and of all that thou hast given me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee. We're going to look, in the time we have available, at Jacob's ladder from four different perspectives. We're going to look at it first from the perspective of Jacob, what that ladder meant to him. Second, we're going to look at it from a New Testament perspective, what that ladder meant to one of Jesus' apostles, the Apostle Nathanael. Third, what it means to us. And fourth, our lessons will be based primarily on what that ladder means to the world of mankind in the future. These will be the four perspectives we want to look at Jacob's ladder. The first part of our talk, we might say George Eldridge Part 2. Now, George introduced it a lot with his detailed talk yesterday on both Jacob and Esau. The ladder dream takes place right after the masterful deceit which Rebekah had Jacob use to get the blessing which he had purchased so much earlier. And I've got to think that Jacob did what he did with some misgivings in his mind. I don't think he particularly appreciated the way he had to go about getting that blessing. He did it because that blessing was important to him. It meant everything. It was something that he was going to get one way or the other. But still, I'm sure there was a measure of an uncertain conscience about the method that he used to get it. And so as he comes to the night, as he is fleeing, and he is fleeing, Esau has said, I'll take your life for what you've done to me. As he is in flight north to Haran, to the ancestral home of his father, he picks a stone for a pillow. That's not the most comfortable. I like a firm pillow, but not that firm. And he undoubtedly has a restless conscience that night. And this dream, from a natural standpoint, has got to come out of that conscience, out of his thoughts of that day. Did I do right? Claiming the promise the way I claimed it, is it really mine? It wasn't my father's intent to give it to me. It was my father's intent to give it to my brother. How do I know? And this dream was the assurance that what he had done that night, that day before, was not unapproved by the Lord. The Lord said, I am the Lord. And the focus of the dream was not the ladder. The focus of the dream was not the angels ascending and descending. The focus of that dream is the Lord standing at the top. That all the angels were a connection. It was the Lord speaking to him via these angel messengers. And the Lord confirmed first, I am the Lord, and I have given you this land, and I've given you the Abrahamic promise. In your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. That was God's word to him, and it was assurance. And it frightened him. He said, this is dreadful. Really, the thought is, I am full of awe. It's not so much a thought of fright, but it is fright. It's something that is so far above him. He says, I don't deserve to be where I am. He said, I am at the very gate of heaven. Not that he was looking to be in heaven, but he wanted access to heaven. He wanted the access to the Father in heaven. Esau was not a bad man. Esau was a worldly man. In many ways, he became a very noble, worldly man. Jacob, by temperament, was in many ways a poor example of character, but he was spiritual. And he was a struggling man who struggled over his weaknesses. And so here he says, I'm not able to ascend to heaven, but the Lord has brought heaven to me. And the Lord had reassured him that this promise was his. And all those angels were merely media. They were probably literal angels. probably literal angels that throughout his life were there at one stage or another. In fact, one of them met him once, and he would not let that angel go until he got a blessing. That's how he got his name Israel, when he wrestled with the angel. And he was given the name of Israel, one who wrestles or overcomes with God, not against God, but with him, who holds tight to the promises that are his. And that's what Jacob did, even though it caused him to limp the rest of his life. So to Jacob, the lesson is simple. To Jacob, it was a confirmation that the promise was really his. And he says, now that I have seen God in this place, I consider this God's house. It is the house of God. And he built the altar of those stones for his pillow and called them Bethel, the house of God. Later, God would establish that house with a larger Israel. He would establish with the nation of Israel through a medium called a tabernacle. And there he would dwell with them. And that would become a house of God in their midst, a mobile home, a transportable area. But once that transportable house brought them to the promised land, then he would settle residence there in a temple. Old Solomon says, God is too big to be confined to a temple made of hands. But it would symbolize the house of God just as those stones did back then. And it would typify the house of God on a much larger basis. So when you think of the house of God, of those stones, think of it as the first tabernacle, as a beginning place of worship between man and God. We want to go to area two, to Nathanael and the Jacob's Ladder. And this is found in the first chapter of John. John 1:51. And I want to go back a few verses to verse 47 and read John 1:47-51. Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and saith of him, Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom was no guile. Nathanael said unto him, Whence knowest thou me? Jesus answered and said to him, Before that Philip called thee, when thou wast under the fig tree, I saw thee. Nathanael answered and said to him, Rabbi, thou art the Son of God, thou art the King of Israel. Jesus answered and said to him, Because I said to thee, I saw thee under the fig tree, believest thou? Thou shalt see greater things than these. He saith unto him, Verily, verily, I say unto you, Hereafter you shall see heaven open, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. Here he calls that same vision to the mind of Nathanael. You know, it was amazing. Very amazing that Nathanael, that Jesus, could identify Nathanael as a man without guile only because he saw him under a fig tree. It doesn't even say he was praying. We assume that, and I assume it's correct. I think he was in an attitude of prayer under the fig tree. But that isn't even in the scriptural account in evidence. And it is even more amazing that Nathanael, upon noting this comment about himself, is among the first to identify the Messiah. And Jesus said, You could identify me as the Messiah because I said I saw you under the fig tree? You're going to see something greater than that. You're going to see the gate of heaven. Now it takes on a new meaning. It's not only access to the throne of God, it's access to heaven itself. And he would see that too. But a line of communication would be established between Nathanael and any of the apostles. But Nathanael is the example. Nathanael and Jehovah. And this line of communication would come on this ladder, and this ladder is identified now as the Son of Man. That's where the author of our hymn got those words. The cross. It was on the cross. The tall, upright beam of that cross, the Son of Man, hanging for all, he said, upon that you will see angels ascending and descending. This is what he meant in John, the 15th chapter, when he said, whatever you ask of the Father in my name, that shall you receive. The access that they had to God was through Jesus, none through their own. He was Jacob's ladder to them. And through him would come their messages. Not the literal angels that appeared to Jacob so many times in his life, but just as real. They may be just as literal. They're just not visible. There are invisible angelic incidences guiding and protecting. That's why it says in Psalms, the angels of the Lord encamp round about the saints. They are there as daily protectors. They are there to assure this access. It's because of this access that the Apostle John could say in his epistle, my little children, see that you sin not. But if any man sin, we have access to God. We have an advocate with the Father. And those three words are very important in that verse. We have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous. When Jesus left, he said, If I don't go, I cannot give you another advocate. If I go, I will give you another advocate. That's what the word means, comforter. Same word. I'll give you another paraclete, another advocate. And I can imagine the disciples say, who needs another one? We like what we got. We've had you all these years. We're satisfied. Why don't you just stay and be our advocate? Why do we need another? And that's where those three words come in, so important. I will be your advocate with the Father. But I'm going to leave an advocate here with you. You know, the telephone is a marvelous invention. Sometimes I think it's an awfully expensive one, but it's a marvelous one anyway. The communication back and forth is there. But you cannot call somebody on the telephone unless you've got a telephone. Just because they have a telephone doesn't mean you can call them. Just because we have a telephone receiver up there in the Lord doesn't mean we can call him. We have to have a telephone too. And so he said, I will leave a telephone with you, an advocate with you, so that you can contact the advocate with the Father. That's the Holy Spirit. It's that line of communication. It becomes to us the angels, really. It does what that does. It communicates between us and the Father. In the third area of our study, we're not going to spend much time at all, because the method of Jacob's ladder with you and me is identical to the method it was with Nathaniel. As he promised Nathaniel, you were under that tree praying. Praying we put with a little question mark because it's not there in evidence. You will no longer need to pray in secret under a tree. You will have a ladder transporting those prayers. We should stop 1 second more, Nathaniel. Nathaniel is noted for his action, and we're going to keep praying in there for now, for that action under the fig tree as a Jew. It was as a Jew he was praying. As an Israelite, he was claiming access to God through the sacrifice of the law. And Jesus acknowledged this. And he said, this is sincerity. You are a man of no guile. But I'm going to show you greater things. I'm going to show you access to me without the law. You're not going to need a fig tree to be under to pray. You'll have, wherever you go, a daily ladder ascending to heaven. It was the personal access. And that's what we have. We have personal access. How we like to sing the hymn that we're going to close with later, Sweet Hour of Prayer, Sweet Hour of Prayer. It brings us to the Father. It enables us to share the day's experience. It enables us, when, like Jacob, we're not too sure we did the right thing, to have that assurance that we're still in the house of God. It enables us to have that constant communication. It is a lifeline. Prayer is that one thing that connects us with the Father. But I want to switch quickly to the fourth area, because that's where our subject really comes in. We were at this trip at the Grand Canyon, and as we were there, I was sitting back just looking at the scenery around us, and there's a souvenir shop, built like an old adobe home, And on the roof, they had ladders going from one floor to the next, exterior ladders. It was their staircase. And this ladder had four rungs, and that's what really got me thinking about this whole subject, was the four rungs on that ladder, and say, yeah, and there are four rungs in Jacob's ladder. Mankind in the kingdom is also going to have access to God. But their access is by a little different route. They also will have the house of God. Revelation 21:4. He will tabernacle with men. His presence will be amongst them. But how will they approach God? What will be their Jacob's ladder, their line of communication? I'd like to turn to a prophecy in Hosea that I think beautifully illustrates the ladder and the four rungs that mankind will have. This is Hosea, the second chapter, verses 21 and 22. It shows us the communication link between God and man. It shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord, I will hear. I will hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth, and the earth shall hear the corn, the wine, and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel. Notice your four steps. God listens to the heavens. The heavens listen to the earth. Earth listens to the corn, wine, and oil. The corn, wine, and oil listen to Jezreel. There is your access route to God. You go from Jezreel up to the corn, wine, and oil, up to the earth, up to the heaven, finally to God. That is a communication link that's established. God does not talk to the earth. God talks to the heaven, and the heaven talks to the earth. What heaven? Not the sky above us, not the atmosphere around the planet earth, but the new heavens and the new earth, which he will establish. And what is that new heavens? That new heavens is the Christ, the head and body of the church. And he said, I'm putting you in a position where you are in between where I am, where man is. Man is on earth, I'm here, I will talk to heaven, heaven will talk to the earth. There's a communication link between, an intermediary step. Now that is the role that he has for the Christ. That is the role as described in 2 Corinthians, the third chapter, of the work of reconciliation, of the work of bringing together these two factors. So that's the first big step. These will hear the earth. But the earth also hears something. So there are steps below the earth. So let's now define the earth. The earth today, the globe, planet earth, is made up of two basic elements, land and water. Some 70% of it's water. The symbolic earth also is made up of two elements, a stable element and an unstable. As the roaring waves of the sea, a constant picture of mankind's turmoil. But there's also stabilized earth. And stabilized earth is a smaller percentage. But you get to the end of that kingdom. What does it say about the sea? There shall be no more sea. It will all be stable. Literally, there'll be oceans, of course. That is not a literal statement. That's a symbolic statement. But spiritually, the sea condition will have passed away. So where does the stable condition begin? With the resurrection of the ancient prophets. When they come back from the grave, they are stable, they are perfect. They become part of the communication link, part of this ladder chain that the heavens hear. The heavens hear the earth, and as man comes up and comes into the new arrangement, they also become stabilized. And as they become stabilized, they also have this access. There's a beautiful illustration of this in the temple of Ezekiel, in the 40 to 48th chapter of Ezekiel. In the 40th chapter, he describes the physical building. And one of the parts of the building he describes in great detail. On the east, on the west, no, not the west, the north, the south, and the east, there were gates to get into this temple. And these gates were not as the gate of the tabernacle, a veil, nor were they as gates as we know them, a simple folding object. They were buildings, and huge buildings. And each gate had six rooms. And these rooms were quite large, and they're called small chambers in these gates. Why have rooms in a gate? Well, a reason is given for one of the gates as to why, and perhaps there were a similar reason for the other. Let's talk about the north and south gates first. We're not told much about those two gates. We're just told whoever came in by the north gate had to leave by the south gate. And whoever came in by the south gate had to leave by the north gate. That's all we're told about the gates. We're not told much about their function. But it shows that in the kingdom, everybody's got to pass everybody else. There's total communication. It's a total experience. You have to go through the entire thing. You can't go and say, oh, this is nice. Use my little area and go out again. You go through the entire, and you must pass the altar to get through the temple. But the east gate was special. The glory of the Lord entered in by the east gate, and that gate was closed. That glory of the Lord pictures the church. It goes in. When it's there, the gate is closed. There's no more access to the temple. But the gate does not go out of commission. In the 41st chapter, I believe it is, 44th chapter. Let's read about the use of that east gate after it is closed. Ezekiel 44, starting in verse 1. Then he brought me back the way of the gate of the outward sanctuary, which looketh toward the east, and it was shut. Then said the Lord unto me, this gate shall be shut, it shall not be opened, no man shall enter in by it, because the Lord thy God of Israel hath entered in by it, therefore it shall be shut. It is for the prince. The prince, he shall sit in it to eat bread before the Lord. He shall enter by the way of the porch of this gate and go out by the way of the same. So this gate was a communication room, meditation parlor. The prince would come in and he would eat bread. He would sit in one of these little chambers. Now we're not told whether he just sat there alone. That's very possible. Also it's possible that there may have been under priests who came out and communicated there in the room with him. We don't know that. That's not in the evidence. The evidence is merely that he came in and he got as close as you could get to the temple. That's precisely the role of the ancient worthies. They have a role in the new arrangement of things to be the communication link. They can approach up unto, but not into, the heavenly precincts. And they can meditate there and bring back instructions. Whether it was through the under priest or whether it was just by meditation, they come back and they rule the people from what they heard. That's part of this earth link that's in our communication chain. That's this second rung of the ladder. The earth communicates with the heavens. That link is not forever the ancient worthies only. It grows. It's a growing link. In Isaiah, the first chapter, verse 26, we have a beautiful prophecy about Israel. And what is true of Israel eventually becomes true of all who become spiritual Israelites or under the new covenant at that time in its fullest sense. Isaiah 1:26, I will restore thy judges as at the first, and thy counselors at the beginning. Here we have this reestablishment of the ancient worthies, these old prophets, as the top layer of the people. And afterwards, thou. Notice that word, thou. Not your judges, not your counselors, but thou shall be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. So as they are restored, it is not these worthy ones alone, but Israel with these worthy ones at their head who become this communication link. And as they grow, the communication link grows. That's why it says, the law shall go forth from Zion, from the church, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, natural Israel. It goes out and it spreads. But it starts first with this faithful class. That's why they are princes in all the earth. In one of the scriptures that speaks symbolically of the ancient worthies, a scripture that is found in Micah, the 5th chapter and the 5th verse, he talks about one of the first roles they play. A role when Israel is besieged by its enemies. And he says, when the Assyrians should come into our land, This shall be the feast. We shall raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 princes among men. Shepherds, the role of the church, 7 complete. 8 princes, they said, where are they? 8. 8. An unusual number. This gate of the east had 8 steps. Same number. Comes into this eastward gate. They climbed 8 steps to get there. 8 is the number of a new beginning. The 8th day was a new week. A new week started. What is the new beginning? Resurrection. The resurrected ancient worthies. Therefore, 8. They are now brought back to a new beginning, to a new role. So that becomes then our second step. Let's go back to our Hosea prophecy. These shall hear the earth, shall hear the corn, oil, and wine. What do the corn, oil, and wine represent? One of the prophecies that gives a clear representation of this is at the end of Habakkuk. At the end of Habakkuk, he says, though there be no flocks in the fold, though the herd be cut off, yet I will rejoice. And then he goes in and he talks about the earth being filled with corn, oil, and wine. Book of Amos. And similarly, with a very similar prophecy of the heavens dripping sweet, the earth dripping sweet wine. It basically, all three together, one symbol, prosperity. Prosperity shows divine favor. That becomes in itself also a link to mankind. Under the law of Israel, under the old law covenant, how did a Jew know whether he was looked at by God as keeping that? Keep it and I'll bless thee in basket and store. There was an immediate reward-punishment concept. Do good and prosperity comes. Do bad and evil comes. Now the gospel age comes in between and exactly the opposite principle. Now it is do good and suffer persecution. And do bad and now we call the wicked prosperous. But he's talking now about the old law where prosperity showed favor. The covenant of the next age, the new law covenant, will show favor the same way. Prosperity will be there. And as man notices prosperity and the source of prosperity, that they become turned. Man is earthly. Therefore, the Lord deals with him as earthly creatures. Earthly creatures are motivated by earthly rewards. And there's an earthly reward, and this reward begins to stimulate them to go up higher on the ladder. But how do they find out what brings prosperity? Wine, corn, oil also have ears. And they shall hear Jezreel. There is your bottom rung of the ladder. In Hosea, Jezreel is quite an involved symbol. You may recall that in the story of Hosea, Hosea had a wife of whoredoms. And her first child, their first child, was Jezreel. Probably the only child of Hosea and Gomer. The other two may have been children of Gomer by other men. We don't know. But this one was certainly Hosea and Gomer's child. And when he names him Jezreel, he tells why he gives that name. The fourth, Hosea 1:4. And the Lord said, call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Well, Jezreel, a rich farming valley, was noted for at least 2 bloody experiences. There were several, but there are 2 that really call attention. Only one of which our text focuses on. The first one was that was where Naboth was killed to get his vineyard by Ahab. That was very bloody because it was very false and very wrongly done. But that is not the experience of our verse. Because our verse focuses on Jehu. And Jehu was not involved in that. Jezreel was the valley where Jehu finally kills Jezebel. And slaughters the advocates of Baal. He cleanses the land of idol worship. And now the Lord says, I will avenge that blood. But that was blood purging the land. That was blood that was shed, we would almost say, in a righteous cause. Why does the Lord say, I'm going to avenge that blood? Why does he want to take vengeance for something that was seemingly done so well for such a good purpose? And it's suggested by many, and I think it's accurate, because even though the cleansing was true and necessary, the motivation in Jehu's mind was not a motivation of purely serving the Lord. It was a motivation of establishing his own power base, his own thing, and he took vengeance over and above that which was required. There's a similar lesson in the first chapter of Zechariah. God is angry with the Jews, and he says, I will punish Israel. But he says, I will greatly punish those nations which punish her, because they went overboard. They carried it to excess. That, I think, is the point here. The word Jezreel, it's a little homonym in the Hebrew language. It has two meanings, closely related meanings. He who scatters, he who sows. Both of these are proper derivatives of the name. Actually, how do you sow? You scatter. you scatter seed. But the thought is that Israel was going to be scattered among the nations. Then they were going to be brought back and sown again in their land. And that's where the other two children come in. They mean you've lost your blessing. And then later says, where you lost your blessing, you regained your blessing. I'm just condensing the lesson. So he who has scattered them among the nations also brings them back and sows them in the land. That is part of God's dealings with natural Israel. But there's a secondary lesson in there. Israel is to be a blessing amongst the nations. They are to be, under their princes of old, a real spreader of the good news in the kingdom. They are a major player in that drama, the scene. But that drama has already had a little beginning. By scattering them among the nations, their influence has been felt, even during the diaspora. As they were scattered, they identified with all of men, so that when they serve, they can identify. Doesn't that strike a bell? Isn't that how he deals with the church? He gives the church the experiences of all mankind, so that eventually they can help all mankind. 1 Corinthians 10:13. There is no experience taken you, but such as is common to man. We have the experiences of men to help men. That's how Jesus became a sympathetic high priest. Because he endured what men endures. He can do it. Hebrews 2, Hebrews 4, the end of the chapter. And so with Israel. He tells Israel to gather the stones out. But he sends them first to where the stones are. Learn how these stones cut. Now you become the bottom rung. And you go from Israel, where as they serve the Lord, they become prosperous. Then as others say, other nations see this, they say, 10 men out of this, all nations grab hold of the skirt of him that's a Jew and say, let us go with you because we have heard that God is with you. Zechariah 14, the end of the chapter, he talks about the fact that there will come a time when those nations that don't come to Jerusalem, on those nations there will be no rain. There will not be the prosperity. So Israel will show the way to prosperity. Prosperity will show the way to becoming part of the new earth arrangement, the stable society. The new earth arrangement, the spiritual heavens, the church will hear, and God will hear that. These are rungs in Jacob's ladder. These are links of communication between God and man, so that eventually that ladder becomes a picture of the full harmony between heaven and earth. Then earth will be Bethel, the house of God. Then no longer will he tabernacle among men. Then he will establish permanent residency. He will establish a everlasting condition pictured by Ezekiel's temple of a everlasting harmony between God and man.